Before I get started, many thanks to Sharon Maloney for suggesting today's guest. If you've ever been present at the bedside of someone you love who's passing away, you know there's that moment when life leaves the body, and then everyone in the room just tries to absorb the loss, sometimes with tears, sometimes with shock, or just numbed silence. And a few days later, there's another moment when you enter the funeral and there's the body again, but this time it's inside a coffin. The body is invisible to you, but you know it's inside that box. But between the moment of death and the funeral, there's a process, sometimes, that almost none of us get to see. The process where the body is washed and embalmed. Now, most of us are too squeamish to ask questions about what happens in this mysterious interlude, and what you think you know about it is probably wrong. Janelle Charmer is an embalmer based in Perth, and of course, she's inevitably known among her friends as Charmer the Embalmer. Janelle is the WA State Coordinator for the Australian Institute of Embalming, and she loves the work of embalming. It's the only job she ever wanted to do once she was exposed to it as a teenager. And while for most of us, the sight of a dead body will invoke grief and wonder and a terrible fascination, for Janelle, it doesn't really do any of these things. It's not her job to grieve, after all. But Janelle does feel a powerful tenderness for the bodies in her care, for the brief time that she spends with them in that room. Hi, Janelle.
Hi, Richard.
What do you put on to wear to go to work as an embalmer?
Well, depending on where you work, I suppose. My latest job working for a funeral home, I was required to wear a uniform that was presentable for the public, so the usual black trousers, white blouse. If I was actually working in the embalming room, I was wearing scrubs and a hospital gown and the gloves and boots, face shield. Anything that involves a paramedical procedure like embalming, you do need to protect yourself. If I was simply dressing a body, cosmetising or doing their hair, I obviously wouldn't need to wear protective equipment that was, I suppose, waterproof. If I was dressing a body with a family, it would simply be the clothing that I was wearing to work, so black trousers, white blouse.
But if you're doing the full embalming work, you look like Scully from X-Files. That's pretty much it?
Without the glamorous haircut, okay, yeah, right. Definitely.
Once the body comes into your care and you're about to begin the process of embalming, what are the very first stages of looking after that body?
Well, the first stage, of course, is identifying the person and making sure that they're who they're supposed to be. Every single funeral home has an identification process, which usually involves identification bracelets, and you cross-reference those against the paperwork that you're given from the funeral director, making sure that you have the right person in your care and that you're going to perform the right preparation on them.
Yeah, because a mix-up wouldn't be good, would it?
No, it doesn't look very professional. It's also very embarrassing for you as an embalmer. It could also be extremely traumatic for the family. Mm. But after that process has been taken care of, the basic preparation of washing the body, of what we call setting the features, so closing the eyes, closing the mouth. Obviously, it doesn't always happen at the time of death or where they died. And simply massaging the tissue if there is rigor mortis present, because that can be a hindrance to the embalming process. And laying them out on the table in preparation for the actual embalming if you're going to be performing it.
Now, are all bodies required to be embalmed before they're buried or cremated?
No, it's not a legal requirement in Australia. It's usually the family's choice if the body is to be embalmed, depending on, of course, if the person is going to be viewed. Depending on if the person is going to be repatriated overseas, there's a legal requirement that the body is embalmed. It is suggested on occasion to the family that some preparation takes place. Depending on the cause of death or the manner of death, embalming might be suggested to the family, but ultimately it's the family's choice and the family must give written consent.
And how do you begin that embalming process then, once it's been decided that that's the way you're going to go with that body?
Well, you'd start off with what we'd call a case analysis, which is looking at the requirements of the deceased, as in the physical requirements for preservation, if that's your aim. Looking at what the requirements of the family might be, so whether they expect that the person is going to look slightly different from perhaps when they did when they died. The time frame from when the person died to when they came into your care, and then from when they come into your care to when the body is actually going to be cremated or buried.
Like in terms of how thoroughly the body is going to be embalmed?
How thoroughly the body needs to be embalmed, the level of preservation that's required. So
once you've done all that and you've figured out how far you're going to go, how do you then begin the physical process of that?
Well, embalming is basically the chemical treatment of the body to retard decomposition, reduce microorganisms, so bacteria, and to restore a physically acceptable appearance. So the physical process itself is replacing the bodily fluids with a preservative solution, and we use the arterial system.
Okay, so when you're talking about fluid, you're talking about what, formaldehyde?
It can be formaldehyde-based. It can be glutaraldehyde-based. It can be an alcohol-based solution that contains anything that will preserve the body. So formaldehyde is usually used because it's it interacts with the proteins of the body really, really well, and it reduces the decomposition that way. It's also a great bactericide.
Do you have to then get all the existing fluids out of the body?
No, you'll actually use the preservative solution to push
existing
fluids out. Yeah. So what you do is you'd use the arteries to put the preservative solution into the body, because arteries have one-way valves in them.
So how does that work? Because the heart's not pumping. So how do you circulate it through the...
Well, you'd use an embalming machine to replicate the heart. So you have an embalming machine which has a tank which contains a preservative solution, and you're using the preservative solution to replace the blood, and you're using the embalming machine pump to replace the heart.
So you're kind of reanimating the body to some degree.
Yeah, it's almost like kidney dialysis or a blood transfusion. So you're simply putting the preservative solution in and using it to push the blood ahead.
That's largely a pretty invisible process then,
isn't it? It's as minimally invasive as we can make it, absolutely. So I would access the arterial system, making an incision on the body, and I'd be using an artery that was quite large in diameter, because the larger an artery is, obviously, the more pressure it's going to be able to sustain.
Would that be in the neck or somewhere else?
The carotid arteries of the neck, the femoral arteries, just near the groin. When you approach an embalming, you would think about it as being able to potentially access all of the cells in the body using as few incisions as possible.
So once the fluid's going through the circulatory system then, does it harden once it's in the system?
No, it doesn't. Because when you want to create a solution, you use a solute and a solvent. Now, usually the solvent is the vehicle of the solution, and in most cases with embalming solutions, it's water. You'll also have other things in the solution, buffers, humectants, which obviously can potentially rehydrate the tissues, buffers that will keep the pH of the solution to something that you want it to, depending on, again, your case analysis, what you want to achieve.
So it stays fluid then?
It does stay fluid. Formaldehyde, it almost goes gel-like, but it does still stay in a relatively moist liquid state.
So if a body comes to you and it's had an autopsy, does that complicate factors for you? What does that mean if it comes to you after an autopsy?
It does. Essentially, the biggest problem that it poses is that the arterial system is no longer intact, because they, in an autopsy traditionally, they would open up the abdominal and thoracic and pelvic cavities. They'd take the organs out and they test them, they assess them, they weigh them. And then the organs go back into the body, but of course they're not anatomically correct anymore, because everything's been severed. So
there's no need to.
Well, there's no need to.
anatomically correct. Yes.
No. So as an embalmer, what you would have to do, you would have to open up all the incisions that the technician made, and you have to locate the arteries from within the body cavities. So instead of just using one artery to potentially embalm the entire body, you'd need to use potentially 6, 8, 10, depending on, I suppose, the extent of the autopsy and the condition of the body.
Embalming is a means of preserving a dead body. So is mummification. What's the difference between mummification, as in what happens to ancient pharaohs, and embalming?
Well, the definition of embalming is chemically treating the body. Mummification is almost a natural form of preservation. Mummification occurs when the tissues of the body desiccate. So the preservation is achieved by very little moisture, therefore very little bacteria. So the ancient Egyptians used to traditionally bury their earlier mummies in the dry sands. And of course, there were civilizations that were preserving their bodies even before that. The ancient Peruvians used to do the same thing. They used to bury their mummies in the dry sand, and this would achieve a natural form of preservation. They weren't chemically treating the bodies. The ancient Egyptians actually devised a method of that a little bit later on, where they would make the incision in the side, they'd remove some of the organs, they'd put the organs in jars. Canopic jars, and then they would immerse the body in natron salt.
Is this something you're taught as part of your training about?
Absolutely.
Really? It's not just stuff you're pursuing as an interest anyway?
Well, I have
a
personal interest in it, yeah. And I have had a personal interest in it for quite some time, but the embalming course that I went through to become a qualified embalmer had a very, very large module on the history of embalming, not only the physical aspect of it, but the religious implications, the cultural implications of the funeral, of embalming, of the dead body.
So when you embalm a body then, how much embalming do you do? How long is it intended to preserve the body for? How long a time?
Well, the duration of the funeral process is what we like to use as a measure. So for instance, if you've got a person in your care, it's Monday and their funeral is on Thursday and they're a cremation, you simply only need to preserve them for that time period from when they come into your care to when the funeral takes place. Any more than that, we would probably consider to be unnecessary. As an embalmer, from an ethical point of view, you don't want to do anything to the body that you don't have to. You want to keep it as minimally invasive as possible. You can have people in your care that may be repatriated internationally, so you would need to preserve them for longer. You don't know how long they're going to be on planes for. You don't know what's going to happen to them when they get to their destination. So you could potentially embalm somebody to last eternally. Obviously, if you don't have access to that person, it's hard to tell whether it's worked or not.
We're talking about Lennon.
Like Lennon. But they have an upkeep program where they can actually go in and check him and do any other kind of sort of maintenance work that they need to do.
I heard a story about him that one day someone was going through seeing him lying in state there and embalmed and then saw an ear had fallen off.
Well, I don't think that would be true. I mean, body parts don't usually fall off like that, especially if the person's been embalmed. What usually happens when somebody's been embalmed for as long as Lennon has been, usually they will dehydrate more than anything else. And that's a form of mummification. So no, an ear wouldn't fall off. It might shrivel and go a little bit dark, but I don't think it would fall off.
In most old cemeteries, there are mausoleums where bodies are interred there above ground.
Yes.
Does that still happen?
Absolutely.
And people would need to be thoroughly embalmed?
Yes, very thoroughly embalmed, yes.
How long for?
It depends. Each state, so in Western Australia, most of our cemeteries are owned by the government. So they will determine how long you can lease the grave or the mausoleum for. In other states, it varies. So every single state is different. In Western Australia, the reason that there are leases on graves or on mausoleums is for several reasons. One of those is so the cemetery can have what they call a renewal program. There was a lot of hype about this in the media recently where people interpreted that term renewal as that the coffins were going to be dug up. And so that to make room for other graves, which isn't the case at all.
It's not?
No, not at all. what would they do with all those coffins? Yeah. what the cemetery was trying to do was utilise the space in between the existing graves. A lot of the times, if there's nobody left in the family to go and care for the grave, the cemetery will have this grave where nobody's taking care of it, nobody's going and making sure that the headstone is still in place. You know, you have issues with vandals, the weather, these things erode up over time. And after 50 to 70 years, there might not be anybody left in the family that's going and visiting the grave. Now, the cemetery don't want to disrespect that family or that grave, but there's only a set amount of land in Western Australia that you can use as a cemetery. You can't just keep building new cemeteries because you have to think you've got to have a piece of land that isn't going to be used in 50 years' time to have an airport put on it or a highway put through it. You have to have something that doesn't have underground power or underground water that could be an issue. You have to have somewhere that's accessible for people that they're going to be able to come to. So you can't just keep building new cemeteries. So with things like mausoleums and graves in Western Australia, there is a lease, but the family nominate whether they want to keep renewing that lease or not.
Are there any bodies you can't embalm?
Practically, I suppose the only body that you couldn't embalm is one that doesn't have enough structural integrity for you to actually perform the physical act of embalming.
When you say that, do you mean someone who's been so badly injured?
Yes, but you can always perform some kind of preservation, whether it's through the application of surface chemicals or injecting hypodermically an embalming solution. It may be a little bit more difficult and it may mean that you aren't able to present the family with something that they might be able to view, but if you need to preserve the body, then there is always something that can be done. Morally, there are religions and cultures that don't endorse embalming. I suppose there are difficult cases to embalm that you may not always achieve the outcome that you'd like to.
I'm with Janelle Charmer, also known as Charmer, the embalmer, a woman who has made embalming her life's vocation, and it's a job she absolutely loves. She is also the chief technician currently of the clinical training and Evaluation Centre at University of WA's School of Surgery, and she's the WA State Coordinator for the Australian Institute of Embalming, where she acts as a mentor, trainer, and a coordinator. You grew up more or less sort of on a farm. Your dad had a farm south of Perth. Does that mean you had that kind of rural childhood where you sort of go around knocking about the farm, doing all kinds of stuff in the creek, doing all those things?
I had the best of both worlds. So I lived with my mum in Perth, and then on a lot of school holidays, my twin sister and I would go and spend weeks on end with my father in Albany, which is about 5 hours south of Perth. So I got the best of everything. I got to live in the city and I got to play sports and do all those other wonderful things. And then I got to spend weeks on end building cubby houses and riding horses and chasing cows and all the other wonderful things that none of my city friends got to do. So it certainly gave me a well-rounded childhood.
Did it expose you to death in a way that stopped you being squeamish too? Because farmers know about death.
Certainly. It did. I suppose as a child you're always curious and you don't tend to have a lot of the boundaries on your mind the way that adults do. So when my dad gave us an air rifle and we decided that we'd want to, you know, mature from shooting at tin cans on the fence to shooting bunny rabbits, then that was something that he encouraged us to do, obviously, because rabbits are pests. I always struggled with hurting something. I was always one of those people that I decided that I had to be a sniper if I was going to shoot anything at all. Really hard to kill a bunny rabbit with an air rifle.
What, it blinked at you and twitched its ears?
Yeah, I remember shooting one in the leg and just feeling absolutely terrible about wounding this thing. Thankfully, my dad came up the driveway with his rifle and put the poor rabbit out of its misery. But I was always exposed to the practical side of farming. So if we did catch rabbits, my dad would skin them and gut them. And it was something that I watched and didn't really have that much of a problem with. He only had daughters. So we learned to drive the tractor and learned to drive the ute and do all those other things that you would do on a small farm. We just got involved in everything because we had to.
You mentioned you had a twin sister. Were you the classic close siblings? Identical twins?
No, non-identical. We're physically very dissimilar, I suppose. Looks-wise, she's the polar opposite of me. She's blonde, green-eyed, where I'm quite dark. I take after my mum's side. Relatively the same height. We're both kind of giants. But the older we've gotten, the closer we've gotten. So when we were little, we used to bicker a lot. But by the time we hit our mid-20s, we were close enough where we stay in contact almost every day. And now it's gotten to the stage where my mum has to separate us at family functions because we just forget that there's other people in the room. We end up talking to each other and nobody else. It's not something we do intentionally, but apparently we tend to isolate ourselves.
Did that make it hard when once you grew older and started to get your own families?
Yeah, well, she got married a couple of years ago and I really struggled with that because it was almost like I was losing her. And it was a beautiful thing, of course, that, you know, she found somebody that she loved and she felt comfortable with, but I felt like I was being replaced in her life as the most important person because she, you know, she always had me and I always had her as a best friend and as a confidant and everything like that. And all of a sudden she grew up and got a husband and I wasn't sure how comfortable with that I really was. It's made it better though. He's very tolerant of me. He's very tolerant of us and me coming over all the time.
How did it work at the wedding? Were you? I'm guessing there would have been a lot of excellent discussion about giving you an important role at that wedding.
I think it was one of those things where it just went without saying that I was going to be chief bridesmaid. I expected it. I certainly would have been devastated if she hadn't said that that was what I was going to do. The wedding actually took place in Bali, so we all flew over there. There was something like 30 of us at the resort where she got married. And we decided long before the wedding was actually planned that Dad was going to give her away. But Alicia and I also decided that I was going to give her away to Dad before Dad gave her away to new husband. So the villa that they were staying at was quite close to the pavilion where they got married. So I walked Alicia hand in hand, like we used to when we were little. I walked her hand in hand to Dad to give her to Dad, and then Dad walked her to Reggie, her husband.
I think ritual's so important. Did that help?
Oh, massively. It was such a symbolic act, and it was one of those things that we didn't even really think about it too much. I can't even remember who came up with it, her or I, but it had to be done. Absolutely had to be done.
How old were you, Janelle, the first time someone close to you died?
Certainly the first death that I can remember that was close to our family, I was 7 and it was my mum's partner. He was living with us and, of course, had been living with us for quite some time. He was an incredible man and he died in a motorcycle accident. It was winter. There was a truck parked in front that didn't have its lights on and he simply ran into the back of it. When my mum was told, I remember where I was when we found out and I remember going to the funeral.
Do you remember about the funeral?
All of us being in our best dresses. And I remember understanding what was going on. And I remember my mum obviously being very upset. I remember not being able to cry and thinking there was something wrong with me.
That's because, really common in kids, though.
Yeah, certainly is.
You can't fathom.
You can't fathom. No, certainly not. You can understand being upset and you can understand grief, but you can't understand what it means to look down the barrel of the gun of a lifetime of being without the person that you love. And I think that's one of the hardest things for kids to understand when it comes to grief and loss.
But also the other thing you do have is curiosity.
Certainly.
So were you curious about what was taking place in the funeral?
Well, definitely. And I had this wild imagination that because the funeral was a cremation service. So at 7 years old, I was utterly convinced that I saw the flames. When the coffin slid behind those velvet curtains, I was utterly convinced I saw flames. And of course, as an adult and working for funeral homes for so long, I now know that, of course, that wasn't true. But my imagination, my mind completely ran off with me and I was utterly convinced that that was what I saw.
So what work ideas did you have for a life once you'd finished school?
Well, I actually did work experience for a funeral home when I was 15 or 16 years old.
How did you score that?
Well, the high school that I went to had a really strong vocational education program. Every single child that was in year 10 got given a TAFE handbook and were told to pick an industry or a place of work and to nominate themselves for 2 weeks' work experience. So everybody else that I knew was going off to do trades or be a hairdresser or something like that. And I remember looking under F for furniture design because my paternal grandfather had taught me to turn wood when I was really little and I really loved working with my hands and I'd done woodwork in high school before. And under F for furniture design, there was funeral directing. There was at one stage a TAFE course in Victoria and I remember thinking, I wonder what that's about. So I told my school that I wanted to do 2 weeks' work experience at a funeral home.
Why did you say, oh, that's interesting, as opposed to going, whoa, I don't want to go there?
I suppose by the time I was that age, I'd experienced death a fair bit. I'd been to a couple of funerals. Both of my great-grandmothers died when I was in my early teens as well. And I suppose at that stage I'd already decided that I wasn't quite like other people as well. So
really? You'd realise that about yourself?
Yeah, definitely. And when I said to my high school, my year coordinator, that that was what I wanted to do, nobody, I don't think, was particularly surprised either. So I think I'd already established myself as one of those people that wasn't quite like everybody else.
We were speaking about cemeteries before. Did you like going to cemeteries at that age?
I did, actually.
Were you a goth?
I'm not sure that you could say that I was really a goth. That was probably a little bit too much commitment for me. I think I've been far too practical to ever really subscribe to that PVC too hot, and too much
yes,
makeup, especially in Perth.
Yeah, right.
Walking around Karakata Cemetery with the makeup running off. No, I was never really a goth. I didn't dress like everybody else, and I certainly still don't obey the laws of fashion. But I just really enjoyed walking around cemeteries and I suppose trying to imagine people's stories, reading headstones and trying to find a little slice of their lives just in that one bit of text.
So you went to do work experience in a funeral parlour. Parlour, is that what you call it? Or was that just an old-fashioned term?
That's probably a really old-fashioned term. Yeah.
Funeral home. Right.
Yeah, funeral home.
Do you remember seeing your first body in that place?
I do. They were very gentle with me and they decided that the first time they were going to show me a body was when it was in the coffin prepared for a viewing. So they psyched me up and they took me into the room and I remember feeling like I should feel something and being apprehensive and wondering what I would feel. And to be completely honest, I walked in there and I didn't really feel anything at all. I didn't feel shocked. I didn't feel scared. I didn't feel emotional at all. It just was what it was. I mean, the woman looked lovely. She'd been prepared really well. She'd been washed. She had some cosmetics applied. Her hair was done. So it wasn't gross and it wasn't confronting. It just was what it was. It was just a person in a coffin.
Did it fill you with a bit of wonder?
It did. I've always been a little bit in awe of what exactly it is that differentiates a living, breathing person to the person without that life force in them. I've never been quite able to explain it, but it's always made me wonder. And I think that's why I keep going back to you know, working for funeral homes, working as an embalmer, because I'm never finished being fascinated with that.
I feel exactly the same way. And the difference between that person that was living an hour ago and the person who's no longer living, that body there, is so profound.
Yep.
And it's hard to even understand.
Well, you can't
change, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't quantify why it is that they look just a little bit different. They just feel a little bit different. And without going into religion or philosophy or talking about the soul or whatever it is, or the life force, there is something just a little bit different about that person. I was involved in preparing some of my grandparents for their funerals. And I remember with my grandmother, I knew that she looked different. I just couldn't quite figure out what it was. And all those years, I remember having family members say to me, it doesn't look like mum, it doesn't look like dad. And me thinking, well, how couldn't it? They've got, it's their eyes, it's their nose, it's their ears, it's their hands, it's them. But what is it that isn't them? And I finally got it that day when I was helping to get my grandmother ready.
That quivering animation is gone.
It's just not them. Something a little missing.
On ABC Local Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
My guest is Janelle Charmer. Janelle is an embalmer, also known to her friends, of course, Charmer the embalmer. She's taking on a more senior role these days, instructing other people in the art, the science and the ethics of embalming as the WA State Coordinator for the Australian Institute of Embalming. Before Janelle, we were speaking there about, and you mentioned you prepared your grandmothers for embalming. Do you have to ask yourself that question sometimes, whether you should work on someone you know?
I ask myself that question every single time I find myself in that situation, and so far I have always answered yes, it's something that I need to do. In the case of my grandparents, I've lost both of my grandfathers and one of my grandmothers. I think the biggest obstacle for me, especially with my grandparents, it was a mark of respect for me to be able to help care for them. The hardest part was that, of course, I couldn't see them naked. I just couldn't.
Yes.
So,
oh my God, I didn't even think of that.
That was actually the worst, one of the first things that I thought about, especially with my paternal grandfather. He just would have been horrified. I would have been horrified. I'm very, very strong in my beliefs in that the person's modesty should be maintained and their dignity should be maintained as much as possible. So making sure that at least there's some sort of modesty cloth covering the genitals. But with my grandmother, I just couldn't be involved in the actual washing. I had to get one of my colleagues to do it, somebody I trusted, of course. I was there to dress her, and I did her hair and things like that, but she was in her underwear before she came to me, and that's how it had to be, because I couldn't disrespect her that way by seeing her naked.
You know, the first thought, of course, is that, oh, that's strange, you're preparing your grandmother. Mm. But this was commonly done and still is done in a lot of cultures all over the world.
Certainly.
That a relative of the deceased would prepare the body. The idea that a relative wouldn't do that is a new idea rather than the other way around.
Sure. Well, we know, you know, the average household nowadays usually only has two generations living in it. It's a very rare thing to have more than just parents and children living at home. But you think there are other cultures, and certainly with us in days gone by, you would have at least three generations living at home, and the younger generation would always care for the older. That was your responsibility as a child, is to care for your parents. So in that caring role, if somebody was getting old and wasn't able to take care of themselves, you were helping to dress them, helping to bathe them. And I suppose that's carried on to you performing those last rites for somebody that you've cared about. If you've been caring for a parent for 5 years and helping to feed them, bathe them, wash them, and performing all those tasks with them, it's only natural that you'd want to do that for that last time for them. It's quite foreign now for a lot of people that they would do something like that, but I think it's a beautiful tribute to them. And I think that all the experiences that I've had with people that have helped to care for a parent, whether when they're still alive or when they've passed away, it's a really healing process, because they get to spend that last time with them doing something intimate, doing something private, doing something personal. And that can be really, really beneficial for the grieving process.
A final kindness.
Certainly.
We were speaking before how you got exposed to the work by taking on a work experience job at a funeral home.
Yes.
Did that clinch it for you, that
most
experience?
Most definitely.
Why?
Well, like I said, at that age I was maybe 15 or 16, I was in high school, and I already knew that I wasn't quite like everybody else. I suppose I wasn't socially inept or anything like that. I think I had different priorities. And I spent 2 weeks working at a workplace where I was working with grown-ups that had different priorities to everybody else that I'd met. They understood the importance of life and love and family and the finality of death. And they treated me like a grown-up. They accepted me as one of their own. They didn't just leave me in an office somewhere folding pamphlets. They took me out to transfer the body from where the person died back to the funeral home. They gave me a uniform and sent me out on a funeral and treated me as part of the team. They took me into the mortuary and got me involved in the preparation of the bodies. They taught me how to trim a coffin. And after spending 2 weeks in that environment, being treated like I was important and that I was a grown-up, I had to go back to high school, where the most important thing that my friends talked about was how they were getting their hair cut, or what party was on that weekend, or what dress they were wearing to the school ball. And I remember just thinking, I don't understand this at all. I'd rather go back to working in that environment.
Wow, so it satisfied some kind of need you had for high seriousness and for being in the world of adults.
Yeah. I think I displayed an emotional maturity that was well beyond my years.
I know. If I'd have known you, then I would have been so scared of you, I think.
A lot of people were.
So at the end of that process, what did they have to say about you as a work experience girl, given all this high-powered work?
Well, they just wrote these really beautiful remarks about how I just excelled in everything that I did. It was a really glowing report, and I remember just feeling so overwhelmed with how generous these people were with their praise, but also marvelling at how well I just fitted into this. I actually felt like I belonged. Instead of feeling a little on the fringe, especially at high school, I actually found a place where I felt that I was meant to be.
So then out of high school, how did you then break into the high-powered funeral industry? That's the way of putting it. Industry is a stupid way of putting it.
I call it the profession.
Okay, the profession. That's
because,
a better way.
Yeah,
it, yes.
Because we like to think that we're professionals. Well,
you are, yes.
I like to think so. Thank you. I knew that I wanted to work for funeral homes, but I also knew that it was very hard for a 16-year-old to get employed off the bat, mostly because working for funeral homes, you would need to drive a hearse or a limousine. Very difficult to do when you're on your pee plates. So I decided that I wouldn't be able to start applying.
You can't put the pee plate.
No, it doesn't look very good.
At the back of the hearse.
No,
If I'm the client, I wouldn't care to see it, I have to admit.
So I finished high school, got my driver's license, waited the 12 months to get off my pee plates, and then started applying for jobs around funeral homes.
How supportive were your friends and family once you got a job?
Oh, so supportive. Absolutely. I mean, from the moment that I said that was what I wanted to do, my family was exceptionally supportive.
So, Janelle, in the day-to-day work of being an embalmer, when the body is brought to you, how much typically would you know about that person that's lying there in front of you?
Well, stock standard information that you're given is, of course, is the name of the person, the date of birth, and that's for identification purposes. You're not necessarily given the cause of death. We're not always privy to the medical certificate of cause of death. This is mostly because within the funeral profession, there's a very strict ethical code. The family's private information is their private information, and you really only need to know enough to perform your job.
Still, the body in front of you must give you all kinds of clues, not just about cause of death, but the kind of person that lies in front of you.
Certainly.
What kind of things can you observe?
Well, the body undergoes a lot of changes after death, and these are physical changes as well as chemical changes, and a lot of them make themselves apparent physically. So you're familiar with things like rigor mortis, which is the stiffening of the muscles after death. It's nothing to do with the bone, so it's not something that you have to break. But
right, so that's just one of the major misconceptions about your work, isn't it, that you need to break legs?
Yes, I have had that a couple of times where family members have said to me, did you need to break their legs to put them in the coffin? My goodness, why on earth would I do that? No. Rigor mortis is a chemical change in the muscles only, and it does actually pass.
It passes?
It does pass.
Oh, I thought it was something that they just got stiff as a board and stayed that
way. No. So it usually sets in about 8 hours, somewhere between it can start as maybe as early as 2 hours after death. Usually after about 36 hours after death, it does pass because it's a chemical change in the muscles. So the change in the muscles that occurs that brings on rigor mortis, the chemical change also passes because the muscles start to break down. You can also remove it by manipulation, by massage. You think it's just like a muscle cramp, really. If you have a muscle cramp, the first thing you do is you massage it, and that will also relieve rigor mortis. So if there is any stiffening of the muscles, you simply massage it out. You don't need to break anything, thankfully. I don't think I could do that.
You can tell a lot about the way the person's died just by looking at them, surely.
Like sure.
Death by drowning or suicide or
definitely.
Murder.
Certainly. So you can look at the colour of their skin. So obviously when you're alive and your heart's pumping and it's beating the blood around the body, your skin has this lovely pink colour. Now that's because of the capillaries under the surface of your skin will allow a little bit of the blood colour to show through, which is what makes you pink, which is why when you blush and you go red, all your capillaries expand to allow all that blood to go into your face, which is why you look pinker. When your blood's not being pumped around your body anymore, it tends to obey the laws of gravity.
So it sinks.
It does. It does. It sinks to the lowest place in the body usually, or it will simply stay in the capillaries and discolour the skin. So there's liver mortis, which is a purple discoloration, and that's simply the blood pooling wherever it ends up. Usually it obeys the laws of gravity, but sometimes it can happen just in the ears, in the hands if they're down by the sides. It'll usually be in the back if the person died on their back. If unfortunately the person died on their stomach or on their face, that's where the blood will pool. Eventually the blood will also start to separate and produce a discoloration called postmortem stain.
So you can tell then from all that the position the person was in.
Absolutely.
Physically. At the time of death.
What they were wearing. So if they were wearing restrictive clothing, that will change. These are the sorts of discolorations that you that will affect the viewing process. So people don't necessarily like to see people with purple hands or purple ears or a purple face. So embalming can actually reduce a lot of the discolorations or remove them entirely.
And this might be a really silly question, but if it looks like a gruesome kind of death, do you think to yourself, oh, you poor thing?
Definitely. Absolutely. One of the hardest jobs of being an embalmer is you do it because you have empathy, but it's also one of the hardest things about being an embalmer. So you can approach an embalming and see the person, but it's really hard to be able to rein yourself back, especially if it was a traumatic death, if it was a suicide, if it was a homicide. So I try to look at them as a series of tasks to be performed because it's not my job to grieve. My job will not be any easier by being sad. I will do my job better by being empathetic.
Yeah, I'm not talking about grief though, because you don't know that person, but
no.
But natural sympathy.
Yeah, certainly.
It's not empathy because the person's dead, so it's a kind of sympathy then. Are you keen to know more? Are you tempted to look at obituaries or something to see the link between the person and...
Yes. I have read obituaries. I have asked funeral directors for a little more information. Natural curiosity, not so much, but perhaps... more of looking for more of a connection for that person, which no, doesn't affect the embalming process at all. But as a person, I suppose it's easier for me to get some sort of closure if you know a little bit more instead of being left wondering.
Do you ever talk to the body?
Yes, all the time. not usually anything particularly conversational, but I always greet them. I often talk to them during the embalming process. If it's not going the way I liked or the way I would have hoped, I have found myself apologising to the person if I have to maybe make extra incisions. Sometimes I have spent several days working on just one person, getting them ready, and I can't help but form a bond because embalming is a practical process, but it's also, I think, an emotional process because I understand how difficult grief and death can be. And I want to make sure that I'm doing the right job by this person and by their family. And I get emotionally involved in making sure that, especially if it's a restorative case, I get emotionally involved in wanting to perform the best that I possibly can to provide this service for the family.
See, that thought never would occur to me until having spoken to you. I imagined it would be this very mechanistic process. I find it very comforting you talk to.
I think it's a personal thing. I have known other embalmers that don't get as emotionally involved. I've met other embalmers that get just as emotionally involved as what I do. So I think it comes down to the person as an embalmer.
Do you say things to the body that would comfort them or give them pleasure? Like, do you bring them good news or?
Yeah, I have read obituaries. Like I've been on my lunch
break.
Really? Yeah, and I've read an obituary, and there was been an obituary in the paper, and it said, you know, to blah blah blah, and you know, from your loving brother. And I'll go back into the person. I'll say, your brother wrote this beautiful obituary about you, and I just wanted you to know.
That's so nice.
I know.
That's lovely.
It is. And I don't even think about it anymore. It's just what I do. I don't fight it. It feels right to me, so I do it. Some people would probably think that's a little bit over the top, but I don't know that person might not have enjoyed that sort of thing. And far be it for me to say, well, now that person's dead, their soul's no longer there or they can't hear anything, because I just don't know and I don't want to assume.
Have you had occasions when the dead person has left you a message in advance of preparing them?
We have had occasions where, say, if the person's been ill and they know that they're going to die, so terminal cancer, and they've decided that their funeral is something that's coming up and they've been involved in the process, so they'll help their family to talk about maybe the music that they want played or who's going to do the eulogy, who's going to say what. The whole event of a funeral is a very, very strong social custom. It's just as much about the people that are left behind than it is about the person that's died. We had this really incredible experience a few years ago for a funeral home that I was working for where the woman that had passed away from cancer had been really strongly involved in a funeral and had actually written us a letter detailing her preparation, I suppose.
Where was the letter?
The family had actually made sure it was in with the outfit that she'd chosen for herself and then given to us at the mortuary by the funeral director. So we open this bag and there's this beautiful outfit and her jewellery and everything that she'd chosen, all her makeup, and this letter from her saying, to the girls that work in the mortuary. And she told us how important it was that the funeral was the occasion that she had in her mind, a celebration of her, and it was to be something beautiful. And she wanted to look beautiful for her family because it had been something that was talked about for so long, almost like a wedding. It had been something that was talked about for so long and there was so much apprehension about this day. She just wanted it to go smoothly and well for her family.
Janelle, is that a bit like the body opening its mouth and talking to you?
Yes, very much so. And it was an incredibly unique opportunity because I'm standing there reading this letter and then I'm looking at this woman and I'm thinking, my God, that border has been crossed. I know that she wrote that before she died, but it was such an incredible, incredibly personal thing to do. And I felt really humbled that she trusted us enough to write a letter to us and to know that we were going to respect her wishes.
You see right there, that's blowing my mind. Did it feel odd to you or how did that make you feel?
No, I wish that it happened more often because death is a very personal thing. And I think at some point in everybody's life, they know that they're going to die and they need to acknowledge that and take responsibility for it. And this woman wasn't afraid of her death. And she wasn't scared of what was going to happen to her. She owned it and she made it her own. And that's an incredibly powerful thing to do when you know that you're going to die. And she transformed it from something where she would have felt helpless. And there were times that she would have felt very out of control. And she changed that and she took the power back. I thought that was amazing. And I'd like to see it happen more often.
Funeral homes, mortuaries are the sites of so many ghost stories.
They are.
Have you ever had any unsettling experiences?
One of the most interesting experiences I ever had, I was working for a little mortuary and the flooring was really, really old and lumpy. So they'd given us these enormous industrial rubber mats to stand on. And they were quite thick. You know, the ones that the checkout chick
used? Yeah. Yeah, behind bars.
Yeah, that's the one. So they were really thick and you could actually feel if somebody stepped onto the mat with you. I mean, these mats were enormous. They were sort of 3 metres by 2 metres in some areas. And I was working in this little mortuary by myself and all my colleagues were out of the room and I had my back to the door and I was preparing this woman. I was actually applying her cosmetics and doing her hair and I feel somebody step onto the mat behind me and then place their hand on my shoulder and, of course, I turned around and there's nobody there. It was like somebody stood up behind me, put their hand on my shoulder and peeked over to see what I was doing. And I wasn't frightened at all. It was actually just felt like somebody was checking up on what I was doing.
So it wasn't a bad thing?
No, not at all. Not at all. I've never felt frightened. I just smiled and I just said to whoever it was, okay, obviously just looking what I'm doing. Are you happy there? And I just kept doing what I was doing.
How important is it for you to reserve judgment on the people you're working on, people who have died for whatever reason?
Well, our job is to prepare them for their funeral. However you want to get personally involved in what you think is their life, it, again, is a personal choice and it comes down to every embalmer individually. I don't believe it's our job to judge people, certainly not on what we think we know, but that's the same for people that are alive. You know, you don't know people's stories. You don't know what's happening to them. You don't know what's going on in their private lives. So it's not your position to judge. I've prepared people that have been well known and I've prepared people that have only been known within their families. But to me, everybody is important and everybody deserves respect.
Sometimes in a suicide case, people, fairly or unfairly, will blame the person who was suicided.
Certainly.
Have you ever had to pull anyone up for passing judgment like that?
Unfortunately, quite a few times. I think people will have their own opinions about suicide, but I don't believe that the workplace is somewhere that that should be aired, especially not in a mortuary where it's supposed to be a sanctuary. It's supposed to be a place of respect. It's supposed to be a place where you leave your own preconceived ideas and judgments at the door. Unfortunately, I had situations. I was preparing a girl who had committed suicide. She was 16 years old. And her family, quite rightly, decided that they wanted her to be put in her coffin in the dress that she'd made for herself for her school ball. And it was this incredible dress. It was funky colours and materials, and she really, really just did something completely out there and completely individual. And I respected that because I understood what that's like. One of the older gentlemen that I worked with, who'd been working for funeral homes for a very, very long time, walked in and saw her placed in her coffin, and I'd spent a very, very long time getting her ready, and I'd invested a lot of emotional energy in making her look as good as I could for her family. And he walked in and took one look at her and said, "Are you joking?" Referring to her outfit. And I said, "No, actually, I don't see anything remotely funny about a 16-year-old girl being in a coffin." And he understood what I meant and left the room. I found that really offensive. For one thing, the girl was simply expressing who she was when she made that dress. For another thing, she couldn't stick up for herself, so that was my job.
When you have to prepare a body for a viewing, that's a big job, isn't it? Because you have to make them look like they're sleeping, I suppose. They're alive but sleeping. Is that yes. How you see it?
It's probably the closest you could get to death is sleeping, because your eyes are shut and you're motionless and your face is relaxed. A lot of people have said they've walked in and they've seen whoever it is in the coffin, they've said they just look like they're sleeping. They look like they could wake up at any moment. And I think that's a beautiful thing, because you associate being asleep with being peaceful. And I think that's also how you should view somebody that's died, is that they're actually peaceful. That's obviously quite difficult if the person's had a particularly traumatic cause of death. In cases where restoration is necessary, if there's been any damage or injury to the head, that can be very difficult to make them look peaceful, especially if they've had trauma, where you either have to, say, bandage it or try and cosmetise over the top of it, or maybe even use restorative wax to build the features back up.
Well, sometimes family members or friends lash out at you, you know, as a way of projecting their displaced grief and trauma about someone
Certainly.
Who's died.
Yeah, because as an employee of a funeral home, you represent all the things that are going wrong to them. And they might not mean it personally, and I never take it personally. But certainly people have become aggressive or certainly very non-cooperative at funerals. I've had funeral directors say to me, "Oh, be careful of this family, they're difficult." And I always say, "Well, of course they're difficult, they've lost somebody that they care about." Personally, I've never had an experience where somebody said to me, "This family is difficult," and I found them difficult. If you approach them honestly and openly, they're very receptive to you. I have had people come into a viewing and say, "That's not my dad." And I always get that little fear in the back of my head going, "Oh my goodness, have we got the right body?" But what they mean is their dad is no longer their dad. That's just his body.
We spoke a bit earlier about you preparing your grandmothers. There was a time when you and your sister lost a child and you actually prepared that child.
Yes.
What led you to thinking that would be the best way to go about that, you know? Why did you want to do that job? I don't know if you wanted to do that job, or what was your thinking behind that anyway?
I did want to do that for my sister. My sister and her husband lost their son. It was about this time last year. He was stillborn. He was full term. I wanted to do the right thing by my family. I wanted to do the right thing by my nephew. I'd promised, of course, my sister that I would take care of him, and she reciprocated that feeling and she wanted me to take care of him. I certainly didn't want anybody else touching him. It's not that I didn't trust any of my colleagues or any of the people that I knew. I'd simply made that promise to her and to him that I would. And so that was what I did.
Did it take a lot out of you?
Very much so. The problem with being a professional working for funeral homes for so many years is that no matter your involvement in a death in the family, you're always expected to step up and to play that role, even when you're not on the clock. So when my nephew died, I wasn't even working for a funeral home anymore. I was working for the university. But because of my contacts, because of my history, I was able to play an enormous role in his care and in the funeral. It helped me with my grief to perform practical tasks. That's a well-known fact. When people are grieving, they need to achieve even just the smallest things to get them through the day. So that was very important to me that I had something to do, because grief is such a helpless feeling.
How do you feel about it now?
In all honesty, I think it's the first time where I've sat back and thought maybe that wasn't the right thing for me to do. Not because I didn't do the right thing by my family, but simply because I can never unremember. I think it stopped me from grieving as well as I probably should have. It gave me a responsibility that I don't know that I was emotionally equipped to handle. Certainly that I was the go-between for the funeral and my family. So perhaps I wasn't as gentle on myself as I could have been, and perhaps I didn't allow myself to grieve. I tried to be Janelle the embalmer, Janelle the funeral director.
Be strong for other people.
Exactly. And while that's everybody's role in grief is to be strong for other people, I think I probably wasn't gentle enough on myself. So I couldn't have allowed it to be any other way. I don't think I could have allowed anybody else to take care of him. I knew that I had to do it myself. I just wish that it hadn't been the case. I wish I hadn't had to have done it.
So you've moved out of a day-to-day embalming role now.
Yes.
What's your role now at the School of Surgery, the University of WA?
Well, within the School of Surgery, we have the Hill Surgical Workshop, which is essentially a laboratory set up to be a giant operating theatre of sorts. And what we do is we provide simulation-based training for medical professionals. So that can be everything from teaching med students how to suture to performing complicated operations and procedures with surgeons and doctors and nurses. My role in there is a purely technical role. So I am involved in setting up all of the instrumentation, medical equipment, any of the actual simulation that we're using. So it can be a synthetic model. A pad that's got synthetic skin on it for people to practice suturing, to a combination of animal material that we will use to represent human organs, and people will perform procedures on those, right up to using the bodies that are donated to the university as part of the bequest program. And we will use those for operations, for procedures with surgeons, with doctors, people that are medically trained.
Do you see as part of your role to be the, maybe it's a bit grand sounding, but the protector?
Yes.
Of that body.
Yes, very much so.
That's been donated.
Yes, that wasn't in my job description, but it's something that I've taken on. I couldn't help myself. 13 years of working for funeral homes, I always say, and I know a lot of embalmers, you can take the girl out of the mortuary, but you can't take the mortuary out of the cow. So whether they like it or not, I see myself as the protector.
Do you warn your partners of this?
it does tend to, sort of divide people socially. What I do. I'm very lucky in that I've never had an issue with my partners and what I do for work. I don't know whether I intentionally or unintentionally seek out people that are perhaps a little left to centre themselves.
Yeah, but you don't say, like, before we go out to dinner, you should know, you can take the girl out of the mortuary, but you can't take the mortuary out of the girl. You warn them like that?
No. What do you do for work? That's such a common saying, isn't it? It's one of the first things out of some people's mouths. There have been some situations where I've told people and they have just looked like they've been hit by a truck. sometimes I don't tell people at all. Sometimes I might make something up. If I'm out, it's a Saturday night and I'm with a group of peers and I don't feel like talking about my job, then I won't.
So what do you say? You're a beautician?
No, I don't even do that. I've been right out there and sometimes made up something completely fantastical that I couldn't even back up. But just to not have to talk about my job, I think that because it is such a big part of my life and it's formed such a big part of my thinking, I don't even know what came first. Did I think like an embalmer and then become an embalmer, or wasn't I an embalmer and then I started thinking like one? I don't know. But if I meet somebody and I spend an entire evening talking about my job, they can have a 3-hour conversation with me but never actually find out anything about me other than what I do. Sometimes I can hide behind that. If I don't want to talk about myself personally, I can tell somebody, yeah, this is what I do for a job, and they'll go, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. And then I don't have to talk about anything else.
But have you ever considered the idea that, you know, it's often said that we're kind of, as a society, we're strange about death now.
Yes.
In a way that we haven't been. Have you ever thought that maybe you're the only sane person and the rest of us are crazy? The rest of us are out of our minds about this stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm so comfortable with it. I have of course, had people tell me that there's something wrong with me because I'm so comfortable with it. But then at the same time, well, I go, well, I surround myself with all these other embalmers and funeral directors and you guys are actually the minority now.
Who tells you there's something wrong with you?
Exactly.
Who tells you that? Seriously, what people in parties, they tell you there's something wrong with you?
I remember I was at a pub one night and this guy had been following me around all evening and I just thought, oh, no, here we go. And I thought, how am I going to get rid of this guy? And as I was leaving, he followed me out and he's like, you know, so what do you do for a job? And I went, I'm an embalmer. And he went, you what? I said, I'm an embalmer. I work for a funeral home. I prepare dead people. And he backed away with his eyes enormous and then ran screaming to his mates and went, you'll never believe what she does for work. She works with dead people. And I thought, well, that fixed it. I get a lot of people doing that. I see dead people. Yes. I've never heard that one before. Please tell me more. Yes, I work in the dead centre of town. Mm. Everybody's dying to get into it. You've got any more jokes that I haven't heard yet? Right up to people accusing me of being a necrophiliac.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
Maybe this is maybe this is why you like working with, you know, dead bodies, because they don't say stupid things like that.
No, really,
to you,
really
do they?
Don't. No, they don't. No. So I do think I'm the normal one. Okay. Everybody else might be. I've had some really strange responses to it. And I wonder, like, it's the only thing, it's the only thing that you can be sure of in this life is dying. Why are you so surprised that it happens?
When you're there in that role at the university and there are students who are going to practice surgery on one of the dead bodies that you brought them there.
Yes.
In a practical sense, how do you try and teach them to show respect? How can they show respect?
Well, if we've got a workshop where we're using the bodies that have been donated, I like to go in beforehand when they've got their didactic presentation. They do the little slideshow first before they go in. And I actually like to go in and have a little bit of a chat with them beforehand and just talk to them about the kind of behaviour that we would expect in the lab. There's this social understanding that bodies that are used for medical research, the cadavers, which is a word I don't really like very much, there's this almost idea that they're not people anymore. For as long as there've been anatomical teachings, there've been a need for these bodies. Now, there was a law not so long ago that you couldn't interfere with a dead body. It was against the law. And when that law was changed and there started to be public dissections and anatomical teachings, there became this huge need for bodies to use. And that was where, I don't know if you're familiar with Burke and Hare.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what they were doing was they were sealing bodies from graves. They were hanging out at funerals and waiting.
And then killing people in the
end. And then they started killing people. There was something like like 20 of the anatomical murders. These guys were going out and killing people, you know, mostly people that were on the streets, prostitutes, things like that, and going and taking them to the medical school for dissection. There was also at the time they were using criminals a fair bit. If you were owned by the state, you were owned by the government if you died in prison, so they could use your body for medical teaching. But what that did was it sort of passed this idea that the bodies that were being used weren't worth anything. And that they weren't people anymore. They were simply a way for you to learn. And I think that that's coming through even now still with medical, with teaching universities, that the bodies that are being used, these cadavers, aren't people. They're a number. So their individuality is taken away from them. When they come to the university, they don't retain their name.
So what do you say to these bright kids who have taken up medicine, who perhaps aren't as worldly as you are and perhaps are a bit... I don't know if they wouldn't be irreverent, but just wouldn't quite have that kind of depth of experience and knowledge.
Well, I basically say to them that the bodies that we're going to be using are part of the bequest program and that we expect that they're treated with the dignity and the honour that the sacrifice deserves.
And how do they do that?
By treating them like a person, by not leaving their instruments lying around, by closing an incision if you make one, by treating them as if they're a live patient is what I'm suggesting that they do. But beyond that, by remembering that everything that they do is an invasive procedure and has been done with the consent of that person before they even died. So obviously if you donate your body to the university, you have to sign a form, you have to donate yourself. So these people knew that they were going to be used for research and they still did it. They knew that they were going to be at a university for sometimes up to 18 months without a name and they were just going to be treated for research and nothing else. That's an incredibly dehumanising thing to do and they still made that sacrifice and they still did it. And I expect that the participants of these workshops remember that, just whatever they're doing. And it does, it takes on a different aspect for them. not so long ago, I was giving these little speeches, and it's not medical students that I'm giving this little speech to. It's doctors, surgeons, people that are qualified practitioners and have been for many, many years. And I still have to stand up in front of them and tell them that they have to be nice to their bodies. But we have had a feedback from somebody, and we've been running this this lab for over a decade, and somebody actually came back in their feedback form and mentioned, we just, you know, I wanted to say thank you to the family and to the person that donated themselves to give us this opportunity. And that kind of feedback is incredible. The university's never had anybody mention that before. And that was simply because I stood up and said, hey guys, while you're here, please just remember that this is where this person has come from and respect that. I thought that was amazing. When I got that bit of news, that just changed everything for me. I knew that I was doing the right thing and I was on the right track.
It's been great speaking with you, Janelle. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Richard. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.